Kevin Pollak, your host for this year. My Mrs. Amazing Pod. Thanks for joining once again. Great, amazing episode today. Oh, my, my, my. So this is our first episode wherein I have a guest, extraordinary Cindy Tolan, who took over casting after the pilot. Once it was picked up to two seasons from pilot, Cindy Tolan was brought in, as she will explain. And so I thought with Cindy and having just finished season one, I would retrace the casting decisions along the way for season one of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And that's what Cindy Tolan and I spend the next goodly hour doing. She is incredibly talented, casting tremendous Broadway shows, television, films, producing the recently insanely successful Death of a Salesman with an all-black cast. And yeah, she's just as great as it gets, and shares a great many insights. So please enjoy this conversation before we get on to season two, episode one. Very exciting guest for that. I'm not going to tease yet. Let's talk about the entirety of season one with the great casting director, multi-award winning Cindy Tolan. And now please welcome casting agent extraordinaire, Cindy Tolan. Cindy, hello.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Oh, I'm so well, thank you. Welcome to the proceedings. I've been spending the last many weeks breaking down each episode and talking to actor types. And then the idea was to get some creative department heads just to sort of talk an overview since, in this case, the first season. And you're in my preliminary text exchanges. You were kind enough to remind me that you had not cast the pilot, so I won't bog you down with questions about that.
I just don't want to take credit for amazing work that Jeannie Bacharach and Meredith Tucker did. You know, it's just like, because we did that together. So I want them to get their credit.
Truly amazing, right?
So incredible. And I have to say, I'm relieved that I wasn't available to cast the pilot, because I don't think I would have done as good of a job.
Oh, well, did. Listen. Who's to say? Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the world at large is aware of to what degree the show's creators are deeply, fondly depending on the expertise of the casting director on a week-to-week basis, episode to episode. So talk a little bit about how you were brought in after the pilot, or were you contacted beforehand and was there already a conversation list if the show gets picked up? Talk to me about your process.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that I'm, you know, so grateful for my collaboration with Amy and Dan. I met them in 2008, actually. And so Amy and Dan kept in touch with me because yeah, I was lucky enough to get hired to work with them on their series for Fox in 2008, The Return of Jezebel James. That's how we met.
Oh, wow.
Really, with Amy and Dan, it was like instant connection, really understanding and getting each other and really yeah, getting into each other's, they say this word, the pocket, you know, and really sure, understanding that we were artistically connected, that you just were in sync, you just got each other. And it was kind of like you knew exactly what each other wanted and needed. And so that was short-lived. It was only three episodes. But then Amy and I kept in touch. So she would see my work. And then randomly through the years, I would randomly get an email saying, all I can, like, I think one of them was like, I did this film Straight Outta Compton.
Oh, yeah.
And I had been doing these huge open calls in South Central LA. And Amy had seen the movie. And then I would randomly get an email saying, like, all I can think about are the open calls that you did out in South Central LA. And your work is just exquisite. And randomly, I would get these emails. I hope I will be lucky enough to work with you again. All of these things. And I'm like, this is amazing. This is Amy Sherman-Palladino. She's famous.
So sweet.
You know,
so sweet. Yeah.
And then cut to 2017 when they were doing the pilot of this and she reached out to me. And I think I was busy. I think I was working on two films and there was just no way, because I also at that time, I knew that for me, television is the most difficult thing to cast.
And why is that?
I feel like it's different now because of the way that TV has evolved into, it's like movies and time is different. But back then, it was like there was a clock on my wall always, and I had 24 hours to to cast everything in a period of time, because if you were working on a half hour show, you had 5 days to cast it. If you were working on an hour show, you had 10 days to cast it. Mm-hmm. And depending on what it was, it could be 5 roles to 25 roles.
Yeah.
And the business model was so difficult in like all the executives at all the studios had approval. It was just very hard. And it was always like you were beating the clock.
Yeah.
There was no the internet. You weren't doing anything on links. Everything was by FedEx. You know, we had FedEx on DVDs. You had to make the deadline for FedEx for the DVD to get overnight, you know, by 9 p.m. So you were working until really late at night. And so I found that the time of it, like the deadline of it, was so stressful.
Sorry, what was on the DVDs?
Auditions.
Oh, so people were putting themselves on tape in the form of a DVD.
No one put themselves on tape. We were all...
Oh, of course. 2017. Sorry. Yeah.
Right. So this is this back in the day when you were doing like mostly studios. So ABC...
Yeah.
NBC, right? You would, the day before, set up a whole day of auditions for the next day. You would start the auditions 10 o'clock a.m. You would go to it until, say, 3 p.m. Then you would edit all of the auditions. And then you had to burn a DVD so that you could make the FedEx deadline by 9 o'clock so it could get to
Jesus.
The studios the next day for them to audition, for them to approve or not approve. And then if they didn't approve, you had to do it again. But you've already lost the day.
Sure.
They were watching the DVD.
Nightmare.
Nightmare. And so I always found it very stressful.
Yeah, I can see why film would be more alluring. Yeah.
And now it's completely different, right? And so sure. I find it less stressful. And also it's much more like movies, I find. I find it's just like there's more money.
Yep.
The talent has increased exponentially, so that anybody that only did movies now really do television.
Yeah.
So it's kind of switched off, you know, a little bit. And so now TV is kind of where it's at sometimes.
The writing and the production sort of drives the entire medium. And it just did shift at some point where people realized, oh, I can have more time to tell a longer story and the better writers.
And more money.
And as it turns out, more money, even before Amazon started writing giant checks. Yes, there seemed to be more money at an HBO and so on.
Netflix, you know.
Yeah.
Now there's Apple, like they're all in the game of it. And, you know, look, this isn't casting, but if you watch one episode of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and you watch a shot that Amy Sherman-Palladino has orchestrated, it is incredible. It is like a movie shot, right? Yep. It's just like 13 pages of dialogue in one shot. Mm. That is bananas.
Tell me about it. It's all the actors have been talking about on this podcast. But now let's go back to 17 when you weren't available for the pilot, but then the show gets picked up from pilot to 2 seasons.
Yeah. And so Meredith Tucker was no longer available to do the New York casting, and Jeannie Bacharach was doing the LA casting. So then Amy came back to me and she said, please, are you available? Don't break my heart.
Yeah.
And I said, actually, I think I am. And I was. And I really wanted to work with Amy. And at that moment, I didn't, it hadn't been picked up. They had just shot the pilot, right?
Okay.
I didn't know that it was picked up for 2 seasons. So I had a meeting. Well, I said yes. I had a meeting, and it was immediately to cast your role, Caroline Aaron's role, and Sophie Lennon. It was like, we know that we're going to have this one big female comic, and we wanted to start casting that right away. And there were no scripts or anything. So it's just based on descriptions. And I think that you know that because you were the first person we asked to play Moish, and you said yes, but you didn't have a script, I don't think.
There was just a pilot to look at. The pilot had dropped, of course, on Amazon is how they, I don't know if they still do their system that way, but they would make a pilot. And instead of doing all the testing that the broadcast networks have been doing, where 7 people in a room who were promised soup and air conditioning would judge the future success of a television show. So my agent said, you're on a very small list, as they like to say. And they said, it's incredibly small. In fact, you need to watch the pilot immediately because Amy and Dan want to talk to you.
Right.
And you know how it is. That pilot, it just takes your breath away. Everyone I've spoken to.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And a show being picked up from pilot to two seasons had only happened once or twice previously. It was another historical thing for a very young streaming platform.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting. It was such an instant yes from just watching the pilot. I don't think I was the demographic for the Gilmore Girls, so I missed that genius as an old white pasty Jew. Man, I missed the Gilmore Girls. Immediately started watching once I thought I might be in business with Amy and Dan. But yeah, that pilot just takes your breath away. So were they showing you the pilot also when you were...
No, I didn't see the pilot. I don't even think the pilot was done by the time I saw it. And I think, you know, we had a meeting and it was so immediate and clear to me that you and Caroline, Aaron, were fit seamlessly into their world, right? Because they created such a world. And I now, my associate, Ann Davison, and I call and now coin it as the Paladino pace.
Yes.
Because it's very fast talking. And that is specific, I think. And if you need to be able to do the fast talking dialogue, and if you can't, then you really can't do the show because it's very hard to learn that. It's patter, you know, it's patter.
Yeah.
You really need technically skilled to be able to do that. And so for me, in terms of casting the show, that's why I immediately... You know, I come from theater and I look towards theater.
Yeah.
And a lot of the casting over the seasons and over the years, you will see a continuous arc of that, right? Most of the people who are recurring on this show have a theater background.
Right.
That's on purpose.
Yes. You
know? Yeah. There are some people that can do it, but inevitably it's like trained people. From theater. And I was familiar with your work and Caroline's work, obviously, because I'm a movie kid of the 90s, right? And that you guys were just always, always on the movie screens, always. You big, A Few Good Men, right? And that was the one that always stayed with me. And Caroline was Heartburn and then the Woody Allen films, right? Yeah. And then I also knew her personally through our relationship with the famous playwright Wendy Wasserstein. So I also knew her as a person. And oftentimes that also helps casting because you know actors as people, and that's a whole other dimension that you then get to bring with when you're casting something. If it's not on the page, you can speak to it.
Yeah. Well, listen, I was very busy in the 90s. Yes. I was a girl who couldn't say no.
No, you were in great movies. I mean, it wasn't like you were just like, yes, yes, yes. It was like, oh,
it was both. It was both. I mean, I was a stand-up comedian first with actually no formal training as an actor. So I went on a couple of hundred auditions and learned how to audition, basically. And by the time A Few Good Men came around, you know, everybody was famous in that movie. And it was Rob Reiner in the midst of batting 1,000 through his first 7 films. And it was just the timing of everything. And so for me, in 1992, to go from auditioning to getting offers after A Few Good Men, that opened up the 90s to a girl who couldn't say no. Because once the offers start, because as a stand-up comedian, when someone says there's stage time, the answer is yes. So that was my only training in terms of getting offers. It meant I'd like to work.
I get it.
Yeah. And the answer is yes.
We'll pay.
So, yeah.
Right. But that's the patter, right? So like.
Yeah. In terms of the patter, I had to play a little bit of catch up. I mean, I was always drawn to fast talking characters, but you're not wrong in terms of it is so specific to the Paladinos and they have a pace that is almost unparalleled. I mean, Aaron Sorkin certainly became famous for his walk and talk. And Woody Allen was one of the first people I saw, you know, comedy played in a medium two shot where people were just talking as fast as they could. And it's compelling almost by design because of the quick pace. So I love that if you could speak more to, were there people you brought in over that first season who maybe couldn't keep up with the patter? And it was the reason why you...
everybody could. I mean, there wasn't one person, because they would come in for me, the people who couldn't do it, but inevitably Amy and Dan wouldn't see those people, right?
Sure.
But what was really so key and helpful to being able to cast season one really well, once you and Caroline said, yes, thank goodness, it was on to Sophie Lennon in the season. We really wanted to get a name, like I wanted to. Amy and Dan did not say this at all, but I really wanted to get a linchpin.
Yeah.
For the season, like an actor magnet, somebody that the world kind of knew, you know, for that role that we would then be able to fill out the rest of the season with really great actors of a certain caliber.
Sure.
And God love Jane Lynch. Jane Lynch didn't see any episodes. There were no scripts. And she was just like, well, sure, let me consider it and let me talk to Amy and Dan. And she said yes. She was available for like the first time in her life, because this, she was doing series, you know, she had done Glee, and then there was another series that she did, and then she happened to be available, and she said yes. Once we got you guys and Jane, we were off to the races, because then we were able to get David Paymer, Max Casella, Wally Shawn. And Wally Shawn had worked with Amy and Dan in The Return of Jezebel James, you know, so you were able to then fill out these people. And they're kind of like markers. Right. Yeah. Like you could get all these people, then all the day players, you just fill in, you create the fabric of the piece.
Well, that's beautiful. And also something I didn't know, and I'm assuming most of our listeners are not going to have any idea how, as you say, linchpin casting. And it speaks to, you know, you're as good as the company you keep.
Yes.
So when you, just like for me, when I heard it was Amy and Dan and their pedigree, and they started talking about who was already cast and who did the pilot.
Right.
I had such admiration for several of the people, including Rachel Brosnahan, who I just loved so much in House of Cards. I didn't see how that character in House of Cards would inform Midge Maisel. And then that speaks to the brilliance of Rachel, of course. So I love the idea of Jane Lynch as linchpin of a level of quality, because you're right. She was never available. The fact that she wasn't able to see the pilot and just have a conversation with Amy and Dan is pretty remarkable.
You think talent recognizes talent?
That's right.
Talent recognizes talent. Skill recognizes skill.
Yeah.
So if you say Amy Sherman-Palladino, Dan Palladino, Tony Shalhoub, Maren Hinkle, Rachel Brosnahan, Alex Borstein, Kevin Pollak, Caroline, Aaron, and then you can go and watch the Gilmore Girls, and then you can talk to the Palladinos, you get it. You either get it or you don't. And the people who get it are the people who are supposed to be on the show. And the people who don't are, you're so fortunate that they didn't say yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it would be miserable for everybody.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the ideal situation is that everyone is wildly enthusiastic when they come to work. And that, as you say, is certainly not always the case. Given the pretty secretive nature of episodes from the actor's standpoint, in terms of seeing scripts before table reads, it's often 24 hours or 48 if you're lucky. But you've got a cast, of course, long before that. So during the process of that first season, what was the nature of the individual episode casting?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny because we will have a meeting before the season with Amy and Dan, and they will tell us, you know, big arcs or big roles that need to be cast.
Sure.
But with day players, we're like you. We get the script the same day.
Oh, wow.
And then we have to start casting. And so it's just about how comfortable you are in the world. And I think that's why the relationship with Amy and Dan is so important, because they trust that we understand the world that they're creating and that we're going to bring the people that are right for the roles to them.
Yeah.
And that there's trust there. And so if they don't necessarily see it, they'll ask an opinion and you're just completely honest. And you say, I think they can do it. I'm not sure. Maybe. I think this is the strength. Maybe this is the area that would need work. And then at some point they're like, do you think that they can do it? And you know, and you go out on the line and you just say yes or no. And, you know, and I think that's the thing, because it's just like, it's your name and it's your art. And just like, you know, you don't want to say yes if people can't do it.
That's right. That's
right. And just because someone can't do this doesn't mean they can't do other things. This is just so specific.
Right. Well, let's break down some specific casting choices and opportunities to fill out the show episode by episode. So episode 2 of season 1, Moish and Shirley are introduced. We've spoken about that. Then we've got Mrs. Moskowitz.
Cynthia Darlow.
Yeah.
Cynthia Darlow is amazing. Now, Cynthia Darlow goes right back to what we were talking about with theater, right? Because Cynthia Darlow has been a working actress on Broadway in theater for her entire adult life. And I also started out in theater, so I have known her through casting, mm-hmm. you know, many, many plays at Lincoln Center Theater. And Cynthia Darlow would come in and audition. And so that's my relationship with Cynthia Darlow. And so she came in and they just absolutely loved her and she got the job.
Yeah.
You know, and I think with Amy and Dan, it's just like when people are right and they're good, then they write to them for additional episodes. So I don't necessarily remember if Mrs. Moskowitz was supposed to come back and be recurring, but that they've just fell in love with Cynthia Darlow, that they kept writing to her.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I had Cynthia on the podcast quite recently, actually, and she spoke to that very thing, which was there was no idea or consensus on whether she would be returning at all.
Yeah.
Let alone for multiple recurring episodes. Yeah. And even, you know, Moish and Shirley were reoccurring initially without any real designs or promises as far as what we were told, how many episodes they would be doing. Now, so episode 3 of season 1, you mentioned David Paymer. Now, here's a character actor who does exceptional work each and every time. What was the process of filling in the all-important Harry Drake character?
Well, I mean, I think David Paymer is another 90s baby that I, you know, that I was seeing in all the movies, right?
Yep, absolutely.
In the 90s. And, you know, so famous. Such a famous character actor that was in everything, that had the same patter. And I was just like, I don't know. Can we get him?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. He's not New York local. This goes back to Amazon and having, you know, more financial freedom than back in the day with TV, which is just like, or I don't even know. Can we fly people in and house them for this show? Or yeah. I don't even know if we can consider people from LA. And Dana Gilbert, who's our amazing executive producer and line producer, is just like, yes, whatever Amy and Dan want, they can have. So if you're saying that this is the guy they want, then we'll make it happen. And that's what you want. You want somebody who trusts the process and trusts all the department heads and Amy and Dan. And so we offered it to him and he said yes. And then they made it happen.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story. And Max Casella, who I've loved for a very long time, exceptional as the great torchbearer and, you know, the fighter in the field for the subversive lawyer Michael Kessler. What was that process like?
Well, that was, again, you know, it was just like, well, then we're going to have this lawyer, you know, they're going to get arrested. And, you know, at that time, Max was on Vinyl, mm-hmm. on HBO, and which I loved that series, you know, and I was just obsessed with it. And I would watch it every week. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's perfect. He's perfect for it. And I've known Max forever, because also through theater, because he's really close with John Turturro.
Oh, yeah.
And I had been working with John Turturro, who was directing 3 plays on Broadway. And we had cast Max in it. And I said to Amy and Dan, I'm like, well, what do you think about Max Casella? And they're like, we love Max. Do you think we could get him? I'm like, why wouldn't you be able to get Max Casella? Oh, he's so good. So that was an offer, because they watch everything.
Yes.
You know, Amy and Dan are very prolific. They watch movies. They watch, you know, television, even things that aren't their genre. They just, you know, they're so hungry for it. And so they, of course, knew Max and his work. And so that was an offer.
Yeah, that's so nice.
Not thinking that they could get him, you know, and you're just like, I think you can. I'm pretty sure he'll say yes.
Well, yeah. And I talked to Max, I remember, and all the actors just said, when the writing's this good, it's the easiest yes ever. Yeah. And then I loved Joe, is it Grafasi, who played Judge?
Joe Grafasi, yes. But, you know, I'm so boring on this show because, again, it's just like I knew Joe Grafasi for a gazillion years through theater.
Well, right? Of course, yeah.
And so that was where Joe Grafasi came. And I do think that Joe auditioned. I think that Joe did audition because I don't think that Amy and Dan knew him. Sure. But again, Amy and Dan actually are obsessed with theater. They go to theater, you know, like we bonded over the fact that years ago I had done the casting for the Broadway show Xanadu. Amy went, I invited them. They came, they saw it. Amy went back and saw it six times. Wow. She was like a fan, you know, she was like stage door, like groupie, you know, and so you just trust and rely on that knowledge because they have an encyclopedia knowledge of the mediums, you know.
They certainly do. Yeah. All right. Moving on to episode four, we see Susie's office, which is a newspaper stand, and it's run by this character, Darius, who Chaz Lamar Shepherd plays wonderfully, and wanted to hear about that.
That was an audition. That was somebody that we didn't know. He was submitted through his agent, and he auditioned with like 20 other guys, and he got it, you know, and that's what they see it. And back before the pandemic, on specific roles, Amy and Dan would want to do callbacks in person.
Yeah.
And all of the actors would go to Steiner Studios at the Navy Yard, and we would they would all audition for Dan and Amy in person
while we were shooting.
Yeah. So it would be on their lunch break. And we would be waiting for them to, you know, wrap up the scene. They would come for lunch. And during their lunch hour, they would audition all the actors for a handful of roles. And they would give adjustments. And they can tell immediately. And they need to hear it. Amy and Dan need to hear it. If they don't know the actors and if they don't know their technical verbal skills, they need to hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they're writing and directing everything, they just know immediately. Yep. They'll know if they can do it or not.
Yeah, there's a music.
It's amazing, yeah.
And then another little role that I thought was juicy was Jane Jacobs played Allison Smith giving the speech in Washington Park.
Do you know the story?
No.
It's a good story. Really? You don't know the story?
I didn't hear it.
So, you know, I didn't know who Jane Jacobs was. I have to say, I did not know who Jane Jacobs was. And obviously, most of the world does. It's a historical figure. And, you know, that she beat Robert Moses in real life. And otherwise, right now, we would have a highway through Washington Square Park if it weren't for Jane Jacobs. And that was all real. And so Ann Davison and my other associate, Nicholas Petrovich, in my office, I'm like, who's Jane Jacobs? I don't even know who Jane Jacobs is. And they're like, well, look up a picture. Look up a picture because you have to authentically like match person, right? And the picture comes up. And Ann Davison goes, Cindy, it looks just like your partner, Allison Smith. Just she's more attractive. Allison Smith is a more attractive version of Jane Jacobs. I'm like, let me see the picture. And I see the picture and I'm like, oh my God, it's true. So we have massive auditions. We see all these amazing actresses in New York. And then Ann and Nick were like, we have to ask Allison to audition. I'm like, no, we can't. That's crazy. They're like, ask her. So I said to Allison, my partner, I said, do you want to audition? She's like, sure, why not?
Wow.
Allison studied acting at Brown University and writing and all of that. But she's not, you know, she hadn't, you know, did not go that that route. She's an incredible writer. And so she came in and she auditioned just like everyone else. And then we just sent all the auditions to Amy and Dan, 20 actresses. And they didn't know anything about anything. We just sent Allison with everyone.
Wow.
I get one sentence back in an email from Amy Sherman Palladino saying, who is this Allison Smith?
Oh, my God.
Seriously, who is this Allison Smith? And I'm like, well, full disclosure, I'm like, she's my partner. She's like, really? Do you think she'd be up to this? I'm like, I think so, but let me ask her. Now, Allison, we have a house in Northampton, Massachusetts. Allison was on an archaeological dig of Emily Dickinson's house because they're looking for artifacts because they're rebuilding her house, which is a museum. So I text her. I'm like, Amy Sherman Palladino wants to know if you're up to playing the role of Jane Jacobs. And she goes, I think so. And I said back to Amy, I'm like, she said she can do it. She's like, do you think she can do it? I'm like, yes, if she says she can do it, she can do it. She's like, okay, get her here for tomorrow for a costume fitting.
Crazy.
And she did it. And she was amazing. And
sure was.
Whole story. It was 98 degrees, the hottest day in the summer. And it's shooting for fall. And, you know, with Donna, our amazing costume designer, everything is period. Everything is authentic. So they're in their wool coats and nuns were passing out. You know, the extras were passing out. Allison was called at like 6 a.m. She didn't get home until 9 p.m. They did the scene 63 times. She thought that she was done. And then they said, OK, now we're going to turn it around. She thought that was rap. No, they turn it around, do it from the back. The next day, she's got blisters, cold sores in her mouth because she's just like, I can't mess up. I can't mess up. I can't make Cindy look bad.
Oh, the poor thing.
But
she's great.
Seriously, she auditioned and she got it on her own. But that's, you know, I would say that I do that. Like, as a casting director, I do that. I cast real people all the time because you can cast anything if the world is so big.
Yes.
You know, and people have to be, people are just are talented and good and they either can do it or they can't. But that is a good story.
That's a great story.
That's a good story.
Yeah. That's
and they liked her so much that they wrote her back in for the next season.
How about that?
I know.
And was that the first thing that she, first television show that she worked on as an actress?
And she still gets residual checks. And, you know, as casting directors, I don't get residual checks. I'm like, you have a check from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yeah.
And then from that, she got an offer to do a horror movie as a poet. And so she did that.
Look at that.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn amazing. I love that story.
I'm sorry, but that's a good story.
No, that's a phenomenal story.
No one knew because then Luke Kirby, then the story came out after she had filmed it and everything. And then the story came out in that way because, you know, because she was good.
Yeah.
You know, and then Luke Kirby, I was getting into an elevator. He's like, that Jane Jacobs, she was so amazing. I'm like, do you know the story? He's like, what's the story? And then I told him the story and, you know, everyone's shocked.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's a story you never actually hear about.
Now everyone knows.
Yes. Well, that's the price of admission. Oh, there's a comic that Midge in episode 4 goes to see and she's taking notes while watching him. And then he later spots her with the notebook and accuses her of stealing his act. But Aaron Sorotsky, am I saying that right?
Yeah. Audition theater guy.
Well, he nailed all the mannerisms of a stand-up comedian. You know, it's my first love. And so we're especially scrutinizing as a species, the stand-up comedian.
Okay.
Yeah. And
How am I doing?
Phenomenal. Yeah. Okay. No, I mean, his stage presence, his delivery, all of it. I mean, clearly he nailed it in the audition, but that was one of the first, I think, sort of polished stand-up comedians who appear on the show.
Yeah.
Other than Lenny Bruce. We're only at episode 4. And, you know, I remember watching the show as a fan and getting that first glimpse through living vicariously through Midge and her journey as the whole show, her seeing that first polished act and taking notes. And I thought, this is the act to take the notes from, because the weird phenomenon of Midge Maisel's stand-up is that her brilliance is all stream of conscious. And so to actually try to become a joke-writing stand-up comedian was part of her journey. And I just loved your help and choice of bringing in Eric Sorotsky. Yeah.
you know, that, and that's also like, it's a challenge and it's hard when we have to cast comics.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's not just comics, it's comics in Amy and Dan's world.
Yes.
Right. And so you're looking for a bunch of stuff because it needs to be tight.
Yeah.
Right. It needs to be tight. You need to technically still be able to do their patter.
Yeah.
Even though you're doing jokes.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, do you bring in actual stand-up comedians?
We do, but inevitably we have more often than not cast actors as opposed to the comics.
Yeah.
Actors who can do it.
Yeah. Not just to suggest that I'm such a rarity, but I have found most stand-up comedians are not natural actors, even though we're all acting to a certain degree on stage in our on-stage persona when we do stand-up. There's something unnatural, actually, about the way most comedians talk on stage. It is a performance of sorts, and many of us will tell stories and act out characters within our stand-up act, and that I promise you, in doing impersonations, has really had a lot to do with how I personally learned how to act.
Right.
When I would impersonate someone, I would sort of build that impersonation from the ground up and be studying the mannerisms and not just the cadence of their sing-songy, you know, delivery. And I had assumed that you would find more success in bringing in actors to portray stand-ups than the opposite.
Yeah, I think... You know, not all comics do this, obviously, but it's like Amy and Dan are very precise in what they write.
Yes.
And this is a big theater thing, too. I know I'm so boring with the theater thing, but this is big, too. It's just like these words were chosen for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
They're specific and they're precise. Do not ad lib into this world.
Yeah.
Right? Because inevitably, whatever you're going to add is never going to be as good as what Amy and Dan Palladino have written. So as soon as you do that, you've cast the die against yourself. Right?
Yeah, I had assumed that you would make that clear to everyone who auditions. Because from my days of auditioning, I would want to know that first and foremost. Is this something where I can play with what's on the page? Or do I need to be treated like a playwright?
Correct. And I think a lot of comics initially are just like, because maybe they're not comfortable with it or the different medium in terms of what they're doing night to night, like, you know, inevitably they would add things or they would add a joke or something. Right.
Right.
And technically it wouldn't work or whatever. And you're just like, yeah, it's going to be the actor. The actor is going to stick to the script and they're going to be able to deliver what is on the page.
Of course.
Whether or not you think it's better than what you're adding, that's where we're going with the decision.
Yeah.
And Aaron had auditioned many, many times for many, many roles. And that's also what the Palladinos are great at doing, which is like they remember. They remember actors that audition and then find something later for them.
Yeah. Well, nailed it. In episode 5 of season 1, we meet the character Herb Smith. And I am dying to know the journey of bringing my fave Wallace Shawn to portray Herb Smith.
Well, I was like, Herb Smith, I don't know if it's going to be a big enough part for Wally or not, but it's just like, that's where, you know, and Wally is such a great person in life, right? Can you, if it weren't Wally, and he wasn't such a great person, I don't know if you'd be able to sell it to somebody of Wally Shawn's stature.
Right.
Right. Based on the size of the part. But because Wally had already worked with Dan and Amy from the Return of Jezebel James, there was already a relationship that you could then build on and just basically go to Wally and say, they love you. They want to find something for you. This is the role that they have that's available at this moment. Would you consider doing it?
Yeah.
And he was just like, of course.
Well, that's lovely. Because he was just so brilliant. But you're right. There's not a whole lot there.
Right. But that's another person like having built a relationship and a collaboration. And then also knowing Wally Shawn as a person, just be like, I think it's okay. I do not think he will be offended. Let's just ask him, but respectfully.
Yeah. And also in episode 5 are the B. Altman counter sales gals.
Oh, they're all so good.
Oh, man. I love them.
So good.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to ask your help at some point to see if I can speak with as many of them
sure.
as are available and interested. They are Aaron Drake, Lily Stein, and Joaquima Hollis.
I think it's Aaron Dark.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
my
Aaron
goodness.
Dark, Joaquima, and who was the other one, did you say?
Lily Stein played Vivian.
Right. So now these women are amazing. And the linchpin for those women was Erin Dark. If you get Erin Dark, then who do you build around Erin Dark, right? But you always have Midge. So yeah. You're like, okay, who would be great with Midge? And at that time, the Good Girls Revolt was on TV. And I believe
wow.
I'm not mistaken. Erin Dark was on that. This is what I'm remembering.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved that show. I thought that show was incredible. It should still be running, and it was amazing. And I was like, I don't know, can we get her for this? And Ann Davison, my fantastic associate, who is really instrumental in casting this with me, just like, it might be recurring. I think it's going to be recurring. Let's ask. And she happened to be available, and she too loved it, and she said yes. And then so then it was about, okay, you've got the world, you're getting the world. And Lily Stein is a great comic actress that we knew had auditioned for a bunch of stuff, and so we brought her back in. We knew that she could do the dialogue. And Joaquima, we didn't know at all, and that was just an audition that worked out really well.
Yeah, she was tremendous. I'm ever so slightly dyslexic, so that's how Erin Dark became Erin Drake. I just realized.
Okay.
Yeah. So I love that she came to mind, and it was the idea of sort of building around her. And of course, reoccurring was a real thing for that character. We don't know how long Midge Maisel is going to work the counter at B. Altman. And that was one of those things I was curious about, where when it first came in episode 5 to cast the counter gals, did Amy and Dan have any idea that they could share with you that how long, how many episodes Midge would be working that count?
No, they always have an idea that, you know, she's going to work there. She's going to work there for a little while, you know. And so if you start breaking it up and you're just like, okay, there's going to be 8 episodes in season 1 and we're on episode 5, it can't be more than 3. But maybe it'll come back for the following season. We don't know. And they don't know. They never have an idea until they start writing it, right?
Sure.
So, but you could say to Erin Dark, it's just like, you could like say that. It's like, it's 8 episodes in season 1. We're on season 5. So it has the ability to be 3. We know it's going to be at least one more.
Sure.
So, you know, that's sure, the yeah. conversation.
A more insight that I'm so grateful for. Now, the next episode, episode 6, we have some powerhouses entering the family in Justine Loop and Will Brill.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
I mean, they're amazing. And Will Brill and Justine, they're both like, Justine is trained. She's, I want to say she's Juilliard trained, but I could be getting that wrong. It's like NYU graduate master program in acting or Juilliard, I can't remember, but immediately has the language skills. And Will Brill works a lot with David Cromer, or had worked a lot with David Cromer, the theater director, who's also an actor. And so they came in, and they both auditioned with lots of people. And that, I think at that time, I think that Will Brill wasn't in New York. And so that is when we started introducing auditioning via Skype.
Oh, Zoom. Wow. Yeah.
And I believe Will didn't audition in the room, but he had a call back and it was over video. And that, again, with the Paladinos is just like, we like him. Can he do it? And it's off of Zoom and tape. And you're like, yes, he can. And then he got it. And Justine was just perfect in every way.
Oh, yeah. I spoke with Justine. We did an episode of the podcast together. And yeah, her version of the entree into this world was very similar. And her recollection of the experience was pretty phenomenal, because it is such a unique world to step into. You've also got a friend of mine who also came on one of the episodes of this podcast, in Nate Cordry.
Oh, amazing. Again, I was like so happy that we landed Nate Cordry, right? That was such a big deal. And I was like, that role was so hard. I'm like, how are we going to cast this guy?
Yeah.
And then what was the show Nate had just been doing? Like, he was just on a TV series.
Well, it might have been Mom, because that's where he and I met. And that was shortly before this.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think it was just such a no-brainer. And then could we get him? Can we get him? He's not New York local. Dana, can we afford him? And if he wants to do it, and yes, we'll make it happen. And then he just said yes. But he auditioned too, though.
Yeah, that's what he said. He mentioned that he auditioned. And, you know, he, like many actors, riddled with insecurities and was quite thrilled to step into this circus. Yeah. And bringing back Justine and Will, you know, as part of the nucleus of the Weissman family has been such an extraordinary gift to the rest of us actors. But it must be especially rewarding when you're involved in the creative introduction of those actors into this world.
Absolutely. But look at you and Caroline. I mean, you know, it really, like, could you imagine the series without those roles? Like Moish and Shirley?
Well, thankfully, you and Paladinos could not imagine it.
Well, but I think it's so perfect that you're so perfect for the roles. They write also so perfectly to both of you.
Yeah.
That I can't actually imagine the show without those in-laws.
You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I remember the first phone call I had with Amy and Dan. And as I think Amy explained it, she said, yeah, when we realized we were moving forward with the series, we did instantly think we need in-laws immediately. We're not sure what we were thinking, not having them at the wedding in the pilot, but we certainly need them now. Oh, I know what I wrote down here was a big transition for Abe Weissman's character is going from being a professor to working at Bell Labs. And David Aaron Baker plays the recruiting person from Bell Labs, his character, Charles.
Yeah, like Mrs. Moskowitz, Cynthia Darlow, David Aaron Baker is a working actor in New York for his whole entire life. From 20s to, I think he's 50s, you know, and again, it's just like great New York actors who audition and they can see it. The Paladinos can see it and they say yes. It's like Michael Countryman, I think also at one point, is he in season one? Maybe that's season two, I don't know, but he's the professor at the school at Columbia where A teaches. And again, it's just like, you know, these guys can do it.
Yeah. Yeah,
I also grew up with all of them, right? You know, it's just like, you know, I've been casting since I was 29, I'm 56. And so it's just like through the years, all of these people become friends and colleagues and you grow up with everyone and you know them.
Yeah.
So you're like, of course they can do it. Of course they can do it. Of course they can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the wealth of talent in New York from the theater must have been where your comfort level makes complete and total sense to anyone in terms of where to draw this talent from.
Because it's like a musical.
Yeah.
Right? Because The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is written almost like a musical.
Sure.
And so people either know how to do it or they don't, I think.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a musical rhythm to that
right. Speedy
pattern and cadence.
Well, and there are a lot of musical montages, right?
Sure, of course.
Girls and all
that. Yeah. A Mary Testa. Plays the first.
Mary Testa was in Xanadu, right? She was one of the two evil women. Guess who else? Mary Testa and Jackie Hoffman, who, you know, comes into. So, and Amy was obsessed with Xanadu. So it was like, what about Mary Testa? Do you think she'll do it?
Yeah.
Mary Testa was like, of course I'll do it.
Yeah, she was great as the first psychic that Rose Weissman goes to see.
Yeah.
As was Michael Nathanson playing Lou Fogelman, the William Morris agent.
He was great. And also, Michael's been kicking around in New York, but he also auditioned and his audition was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful.
I think that's the other thing. It's just like everyone auditions.
Yeah, sure.
They have to see and hear it.
Yeah.
You know.
And in episode 7, The penultimate episode of season one is the introduction of the incomparable Jane Lynch. And along with her, when we go to her private home and we see that she's quite different than her character of Sophie Lennon, we are introduced to her major domo named Dawes by Stephen Hawk, who, or is it Hawk? I'm not sure the pronunciation. Hawk, who is so spot on, Stephen Hawk.
That's just good acting, though, right? Yep. It's like great acting. He auditioned. So that's like, you know, random. And you're just, we had no idea if he'd come back or not. And so that's one of those casting jobs where you're just like, you have to see 20 to 30 people for a role, for one part. And then you send 7 to 10 auditions and then somebody gets it. Or they say, no, we don't see it. It's not right. We need to go older. We need to go younger, you know.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring attention to Stephen Hawk because I do feel like he's one of those actors that when he's cast and fills the role and brings his own special flair, especially in this episode, it's one of those performances that makes me as an actor think he just invented this character. I know it was all written brilliantly and the wardrobe is brilliant and the cinematography, everything is stunning, but his performance is so instantly perfect.
Yeah.
That there's no one else that could have played the part.
No, I agree. It's like there are people who just embody roles sometimes. It's like the glove fits perfectly, right?
Yes. And the other actor who I made note of in this seventh episode, who becomes the new psychic, the second psychic.
Katrina.
Oh, my God.
Well, and that's also Katrina and Tony.
Yes.
Did Dan's visit together.
Tony Winners.
And that's how that came about. That's how Katrina came about for that part.
My better half, Jamie, and I just saw her in Company, and I thought she was revelatory. I really
did. Which I cast.
Well, then I'm even happier with my honest review.
Thank goodness. She is phenomenal in Company. And
yeah.
You'll never see being alive in that way ever again.
No, I thought it was the most brilliant choices of a dramatic performance in that moment that needed that emotion. And I don't know that it's ever had it before.
I think of that thing. It's just like, you know, she's an incredible actor.
Yes.
Katrina Lank. And so she's actually acting the song and not just singing it. So she's doing both. And I think that's what's extraordinary about her performance is that this is, you know, somebody who can sing it, but really can act it.
Yeah.
Really well, you know.
Yeah.
Which is what Stephen Sondheim said when he, you know, at her callback, because she auditioned and he was there, he said, I've always just wanted somebody to be able to act this role, and you did that.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
What a gift in a moment, especially since his passing.
Yeah.
To stay with Katrina for the rest of her life. And I loved
her. That's some good stories, Kevin.
You have nailed it. We've only got one episode left.
All right, come on.
I'll let you get back to your life. But I did want to point out that I loved Katrina also in her work recently and currently, I suppose, and as Claire Shaw in Ozark.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, she was exceptional as always. Now, in the last episode of season one, Chris Churden, if I'm saying that right, plays Dawn, who is part of Joel and Archie's pitch team at the plastics company.
Yeah.
I thought he was wonderful.
Yeah. Just another great actor.
Yeah. And then at the Gaslight, we finally meet the owner of the Gaslight, this character, Eddie, wonderfully played by Rick Stoneback.
Audition.
Yeah. Great. So again, this is all kudos to you. You know, you're sort of saying audition like, yeah, they came in, they earned the part, but you found these people. I just think that's such a ginormous part.
It's just so fun, Kevin. I can't even tell you. It's like when it's the perfect job and when, like, you know, you really understand the people that you're working with, the creatives that you're working with, and when you trust the collaboration, everything is second. You know, it's just like no one's second guessing each other. It could be so fraught. We've all had those jobs. We've all had those jobs where it's like you don't get somebody, they don't get you, they don't trust you. Why did they hire you? None of that exists with the Paladinos. And so what is amazing is that then you are able to just do your job.
Mm.
when you have people who also just respect what you're doing and give you everything that you need and then get out of your way to do the job you're hired to do.
Yeah.
Perfect. And so I will do anything that Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino ever do again in their life if they will have me.
Well, that says it all, because I can guarantee you don't feel that way with everyone you've worked with.
No one. I could say the same to you.
Well, right back at you, and careful what you wish, because I'm allegedly directing again when we finish this final season, and I'm going to be sending you a script.
No, I can't wait.
Okay, good. And now it's on the record. There were these dancers at the burlesque theater that Midge was about to perform in until Harry Drake stops her. But on the IMDb, there were listing of the actors' names like Puss in Boots and Rosy Cheeks. And I thought, okay.
They're all from downtown theater burlesque shows. All of course. In Woodwick.
Yeah. What a great idea. Why not get the professionals?
Get the real ones, you know, it's just like
authenticity.
That's what it is.
Yeah. And then the very last moment of this season finale for me, that right before the very last, because the very last moment is just Midge looking into camera saying thank you and good night. But her ex-husband, Joel, is lurking while she's performing that last set of the season. And, you know, he's really discovering how good she is. But we don't really know it until she gets heckled by these drunks. And Joel follows one of them out of the theater and pummels him. This actor, David Shumbris, plays said drunk heckler. And Joel stands up. And as he's walking away, he's crying and he says, she's good. She's good. And it's one of the most memorable moments for me of the entire series. Mm-hmm. And how great can you comment on in terms of Mike Zegan's work in the show?
Mike Zegan is incredible.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Mike Zegan? He was in A View from the Bridge on Broadway.
I heard.
With Mark Strong and Nicola Walker. Mm. And he was incredible as Rodolfo, right? Yeah. He played Rodolfo and he was magnificent. And I think I first saw Mike Zegan in a play. I could be making this up, but I feel like it was a play at the Roundabout Theater at their second stage, The Underground.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Steele? Am I making this up? I could be making this up. And sometimes I see so many plays that they converge.
Sure.
But it was an off-Broadway theater. But again, I didn't cast Mike Zegan.
No, I know.
But he's so perfect. And I did cast Mike Zegan in a Showtime series, and he was amazing. And it was called Happy-ish. And he was phenomenal. And he came in and he auditioned. And again, he just got the part like this.
Yeah.
So phenomenal. He's so good.
I spoke with him on the podcast. He talked about his audition process for Maisel. And I just wanted you to weigh in a little bit because I'm such a fan of his.
Oh, he's just so good. And there are like actors that no one else can play the parts. Like, could you ever imagine anyone else playing that role of Joel now? I can't.
No, not in a million years.
No.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
No.
And Luke Kirby.
Oh.
Another one of those revelatory performances on the show that.
He is incredible.
Yeah.
He is incredible.
Beyond.
Incredible. Lenny Bruce. See, that's the thing. I'm so happy I didn't have to cast the pilot. I would have died. I had to cast Lenny Bruce.
Yeah. Yeah. So extraordinary. Well, thank you, Cindy, so very damn much.
Oh, my pleasure, Kev.
I knew you would bring the insights and I wanted your perspective of this first season. And if it's okay, I would, if you, you know, give it some thought, but I will check back in with you and maybe we'll do this again for the future seasons after this first one. Just again, an overview of these very special people who came in, you know, during each one of these seasons. I sort of wanted to, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. I'd love it.
I would love
talking about Maisel over and over and over again.
Okay, good. Good. Well, thank you. And there you have it. I know you have a gazillion projects that are moving forward. So unless there's anyone in particular that you want folks to know about, they can just follow you online and know where your brilliance will lead them next.
Yeah.
Is there anything in particular you want to bring people's attention to?
You know, what I am doing is I'm producing a Broadway play.
Yay!
I'm producing Death of a Salesman on Broadway.
Oh, my God.
This fall with Wendell Pierce and Sharon D. Clarke, a Black Loman family in a white capitalist society. So check it out.
Genius. Now, I feel like Wendell did this in the West End. Is that possible?
Did. And yeah. It was nominated for 5 Olivier Awards. And I produced it there. And now we're bringing it to Broadway.
Well, congratulations. That's a no-brainer. Can't wait to see it. Rehearsals are
September.
Amazing. So it'll be,
yeah, preview September 16th, and it will run to the end of January.
Well, I will see it then, because I will be shooting season 5, I'm told, till like mid-October. So.
Oh, yeah. I'll be working on that, too.
Yeah, of course. Well, see you soon, I hope. And thank you again very, very much.
Thank you, Kevin, so much. Thanks for saying yes.
Well, it's been the greatest gift of my life. We all know that. Well, yes. Yes, indeed. Have to say it. Want to say it. How about that? How about that? Well, let me know your thoughts. Write to my Mrs. Mazepod at gmail.com. I would love to hear what you think about what you just listened to. Please, please bring it. If you have any follow-up questions for Cindy, please share them with me. I'll share them with her. She'll record her answer to you on her phone. She'll send it to me, and I will incorporate it into a future episode. That's how it is done. That is how I say thank you to you for your continued support and involvement in the show. Let's now throw it to the mailbag, see what some of you have to ask. Today's mail comes from Daniel. Daniel writes, Dear Mrs. Mazelpod, a.k.a. Kevin. Hello from a, well, not long time, but regular listener. Before I was a background extra on the show, I hadn't ever seen an entire episode of Maisel. I tried 3 times to watch the first episode, and I don't know what it was about the first scene. Something about Midge's attitude at her wedding kinda turned me off. I don't know.
Whoa.
Eventually, at the insistence of my girlfriend, I'm going to interject, smart, tasteful girlfriend. I watched it, and after the first 5 to 10 minutes of episode 1, I loved it. Well, I hope you thanked your girlfriend, Daniel. He goes on, after I did season 4 at the Wolford, I was like, who the fuck built an entire club inside of Steiner? Context, after I did, makes me assume this is when he was a background actor. Wolford being the theater that was a strip club theater built inside Steiner Studios where we shot the series. He goes on, it wasn't just a set, it was an entire real club with an actual flipping stage, with stagehands all caps, several exclamation points. It was bonkers. In season 5, I was at the trade show in the warehouse in the Bronx. Again, crazy attention to detail. I know what you're talking about with a joyous set and overall great vibe. I remember working on set with Lincoln and Dan in costumes for more than one season. I remember Rachel asking Amy at the trade show, how is it looking? Amy says, it's good. Rachel said, what would make it great? And Amy replied, if I was 20. Anyhow, I was a bit bummed I never got to work directly with you and Caroline weren't in the scenes I was in. Well, maybe next time. What was the question? We're finally getting to a question from Daniel. Was the Maisel factory set in Steiner? The room looked quite familiar to where I had all the fittings. I appreciate the podcast, even though all of the content is in the past. I'm sure eventually you'll be doing the pod in more or less the present. Thanks for all you do. Best, Daniel. Daniel, oh, so much to unwrap. Sorry we didn't get to work together. Damn it. I'm thrilled you enjoyed your experience. And that was a great quote of the exchange between Rachel and Amy that I did not know of personally. So thank you for that. What a gift. What a great exchange and another fine example of the hilarity genius that is Amy and the forever curious and wanting to do better. That is Rachel. Great, great, wonderful. You skipped ahead of where we are, I'm reading your question in terms of chronological of episodes of the podcast, but you did circle back to ask a question about the Maisel factory set. So I'm assuming you mean Maisel and Roth, the Schmata factory. We shot originally at an existing one, as I believe was mentioned in the podcast. And then they finally built the set here in season 2, coinciding with this podcast episode that's dropping, which is season 2, episode 1. Season 2 is when they built everything, really, on the soundstage. It wasn't the entire factory. It was a portion. And we did return to the actual factory for some scenes as well, but they did build my office, which became Joel's co-office, but also Joel's apartment within the factory. I think that unfolds in season two as well. We'll get to that later. But thank you, Daniel. Terrific question and comments and quotes. Well done, Daniel. Daniel, shoot me back an email with your address. It's time to give out a prize. And you see how delighted I am with all the information that Daniel shared? That's not the only reason for the prize. It's time to give out some prizes. So this is the beginning of that process as we start covering season two, episode one, and beyond. Thank you, everyone, for writing into mymrsmazelpod@gmail.com. I love your emails. I'll continue to answer them. And please continue to enjoy the show. And again, thank you, Daniel. And so now we close it up. Close up the mailbag. Yes, there it goes. Sealed once again until next week. Will you please rewatch season two, episode two of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel in preparation for next week's pod episode with a very, very special guest. Oh my goodness. Multi-Emmy Award winning, special, extraordinary, talented genius for next episode. Ooh, yes. Let's give credit where credit is due. My research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and my recording engineer, post-production genius, Ken Plume. The fine, loving folks at Q-Code. Q-Code! Sounds like something, doesn't it? And, yeah. Give a shout out to me at mymrsmazelpod@gmail.com. Give a shout out to people in your life. Hey, I'm listening to this podcast. You should check it out. Hey, you and I spoke about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. You were a fan, right? Are you still a fan? Well, I've got good news for you. There is this, and then I'll let you say the rest. But that's the opening script, in case you want to. I look forward to hearing from you. Very excited to involve you in the show on a continuous basis. Until next time, see you in my dreams, and please be kind to each other. Okay, closing credits time. My Mrs. Maisel pod was created by me, your host, Kevin Pollack, research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and our engineer, recording, post-production, producer, genius is Ken Plume. My Mrs. Maisel pod is brought to you by the fine folks at Q-Code. Q-Code. Sounds like something, doesn't it? Oh, lastly, you should know, I'm told by legal to make this crystal clear, that my Mrs. Maisel pod was not sanctioned in any way, shape, or form by Amazon Prime, nor the show's creators Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, although I feel the need to mention I did get their blessing. Okay, good. That should save me some legal fees.
Everyone needs a break from the real world. That's why we played games as kids, and that's why we should play games as adults. I'm Troy LaValle.
And I'm Joe O'Brien. And back in 2015, we started a podcast called The Glass Cannon Podcast, a show made up of comedians and actors playing a fantasy role-playing game.
And now is the perfect time to start listening because we just started a brand new story.
It's basically Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones meets X-Files.
Search for The Glass Cannon Podcast on your podcast app of choice. Hey, life is hard, so come play pretend with us.